Walking to Listen, 4,000 miles across America.
What if I just walked out my back door and started listening and asking with sincerity some of these questions and seeing people as teachers, each one of them, even if they didn't seem like they might have anything to offer, like really doing the work of seeing them as worthy of my respect, of my time and energy, worthy of my questions. And the way people showed up upon receiving that kind of presence from me just blew me away.
That's Andrew Forstoffel. He tells us about his book, Walking to Listen. It's the amazing story of what happened when he decided to walk across America to gain life wisdom from whomever he encountered. Then we rebroadcast an edited version of my 2014 interview with Rob Okun about his book, Voice Mail, the untold story of the pro-feminist men's movement. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. In such a divided America, where people pigeonhole others into categories of difference and then choose to fear and hate that difference. But what if you just set out to walk across the country and talk to people from your heart to theirs? Remarkable things might happen, as my guest Andrew Forstoffel found out when he did just that. At the age of 23, he was confronting some personal crises, not least finding it hard to grow up, to get answers about how to be a good human being, and how to walk his own walk. So he started out just walking from his home, not knowing how long he would be on the road or where it would take him. It took him on an 11-month journey of 4,000 miles across America, and the destination he arrived at was a deeper understanding of himself and his connection to other people. As his spiritual guides, he took with him Walt Whitman's Leaves of Grass and Rilke's Letters to a Young Poet, and then he let his heart and his sincerity open the path before him. Andrew Forstoffel is a writer based in Northampton, Massachusetts. He gives workshops on walking and listening. His book, Walking to Listen, is out from Bloomsbury Press. Andrew Forstoffel, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you. Great to be here.
You know, I have to tell you, this book, Walking to Listen, I had it out in my living room for a while, and anyone who came in who noticed the title said, oh, I got to read that book. And I thought, how interesting that just the idea of somebody writing a book about listening to people was so attractive to people that they immediately wanted to read it just from the title.
Yeah. I love that you mentioned that. It's cool to hear about it. And I think it speaks to just how powerful and profound an offering it is to listen to someone and how rare it is we find ourselves being offered that gift in this culture. And I appreciate that you're offering it to me here and now.
Now, why did you decide to go on the road? You went 4,000 miles across America, as you say in the subtitle, one story at a time. Why did you decide to embark on this walking tour? I mean, originally you weren't even sure how long you would go, but what was the impulse that drove you?
So I had just graduated from college, and I had a few questions inside my heart that had an urgency around them that made me feel like I had to do something drastic to do what I could to answer them. Or if not answer them, just explore them, you know. And the question at the heart of it was, who am I? you know? But at the time I was off asking the question in the language of coming of age and, you know, what is coming of age? What does it mean to grow up and be a man and be an adult? I had supposedly come of age, but there were all these ambiguities around it. And, so before going into a career, I wanted to just immerse myself in some of those questions and then ask people those questions, ask my people my questions, you know? So what if I just walked out my back door and started listening and asking with sincerity some of these questions and seeing people as teachers, each one of them, even if they didn't seem like they might have anything to offer, like really doing the work of seeing them as worthy of my respect, of my time and energy, worthy of my questions. And the way people showed up upon receiving that kind of presence from me just blew me away for about the whole year that I spent on the road, 11 months.
And you asked a very good question, too. You asked people, what would they tell their 23-year-old self?
Yeah. Yeah, that was my way of sort of entering into the heart of things, you know? It was a way of saying, hey, I care about this, you know? I'm not just out here, you know, collecting data for some study. Like, this study is my life, and I need help. I need guidance, and I trust that you might have lived something that could be of service to me in some way, and that there might be some service that I can offer you in just asking you to sing your song, you know, and asking you for your thoughts on things, you know. So that simple question, what would you tell your 23-year-old self if you could go back, was a way of sort of entering the sincerity and initiating the conversation.
I wonder if you would read, there's just a paragraph, the bottom of page 6 to the top of page 7. This was just as you were setting out.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe set us up, but you're going to start with everything took on a surreal sheen, and then to the middle of the next paragraph.
Yeah, so this passage occurs just a few miles into the walk, you know, a couple hours into day one. And I had come across these four Latino guys on the train tracks outside of town, and we were connecting in this way that I never would have really dreamed possible. Or I guess I was hoping that a connection like this might be possible, but it almost felt like too audacious to ask for it, and then here it was happening. We're sitting on the side of the train tracks. I'm playing a song for them on the mandolin, and Martine's passing around some vodka and cookies, and it's just like, how is this happening? So everything took on a surreal sheen. I'd wanted to live this kind of story for as long as I could remember, a story in which a traveler casts off into the big unknown with nothing more than a loaded pack and meets strangers on the road, and breaks bread with those strangers, learning the unique language of their lives before casting off into the big unknown again. It was an ancient kind of human experience, that of the pilgrim, the wayfarer. But as an American millennial and a son of suburbia, it felt like a lost inheritance. Pilgrimages were something to study from a safe and scholarly distance, and wayfaring journeys were the hackneyed stuff of Hollywood, or best experienced in the isolation of your bedroom on the PS3, or in books, not unlike this one. Journeys and pilgrimages, this was not common practice in the American middle class. Such things required a catalyst of existential urgency and curiosity that a lifestyle of constant comfort and consumption suppressed. I was comfortable and secure enough. There was no reason I should want to set out and seek my fortune, because I already had the well-mapped path that would probably lead me to one. But still, I felt something was missing on that path, and it had nothing to do with money or accumulation or achievement. It had something to do with the fact that I was a living mystery, and so were all of the neighbors I'd never met, and none of us were gathering together to discuss that astonishing phenomenon. The phenomenon of our existence and all the questions that came with it.
That's so beautiful. I mean, one of the things that is so, I mean, I guess the thing that makes this book so wonderful is that your voice comes across very strongly of seeking from a very clear heart place. And you had two literary companions that really helped you on that way. Rilke's Letter to a Young Poet and Walt Whitman's Leaves of Grass. Why did you bring those two books with you?
Well, I had fallen in love with Leaves of Grass and had come to really respect and trust Walt Whitman during my time in college. And so I had this tattered, annotated copy of Leaves of Grass, and there was just no doubt that that thing was coming with me because it was my Bible, you know. And I had also stumbled across Rilke at that point, and his Letters to a Young Poet really spoke to me, and I think I've spoken to countless young people and old people, you know, just a guide, a trustworthy guide. That's what I was looking for. And I felt that these dead men would be able to offer me some kind of guidance through their words from the grave. And I actually also took Khalil Gibran, the prophet. I didn't read that as much, but he was there with me too.
And so I was moved to go look at Rilke's Letters to a Young Poet before talking with you. And it struck me that his advice is very much in the vein of what I was just talking about, of really paying attention to what is within you so that you can also pay attention to what is outside of you.
Yeah. He seems to be a real proponent of receiving that which has served you. You know, he has a line somewhere in there of, you know, why would you try to eradicate uneasiness from yourself when you don't know what work it's doing inside you? I just paraphrased it, but it's like, whoa, I'd never really considered about how I might be doing myself a disservice by trying to get rid of anxiety. Like the thought that, whoa, maybe anxiety is doing some kind of good work inside me, like opening myself up to the possibility that struggle and suffering might have some kind of redemptive seeds in there somewhere, some kind of seeds of learning. And he's also a proponent of solitude and the work that can be done there. And so he was a huge guide for me in that way, an instructor.
Andrew Forsthoffel, you talk a lot in this book, Walking to Listen, about solitude and also loneliness. I mean, as much as you were talking to other people, there is this kind of dialectic between loneliness, people, solitude. Could you talk about that?
It turned out to be very important. All the time alone was kind of the balance. It was sort of the introspective balance to all of the extroversion that I was experiencing with people and all these connections. And it gave me time to come back home to myself and integrate some of what I had heard and or vent, you know, because the listening wasn't always easy. Sometimes it was really hard. And the time alone gave me space to process and vent so that it didn't spill out onto the next person I met, you know. And it was also the time when I got to learn, yeah, how to listen to myself, how to be with myself, hold myself, show up to myself. Not that, you know, it's really possible to exist apart from anyone else or anything else because we're all interconnected and interdependent. But ultimately, you know, no one's going to be able to live my life for me, die my death for me. You know, I had to be born. You know, no one did that for me. My mom was a part of it, but we all have to walk our own walk. And I think that's literally what I was learning how to do, but also figuratively too, just learning how to receive all of myself, all parts of myself. There's a beautiful poem by this Japanese poet from like the 13th century, Izumi Shikibu, and I've been hanging out with this one recently. It's watching the moon at dawn, solitary, mid-sky. I knew myself completely, no part left out. And I just love that because of what it suggests about all these parts that I had spent so much time trying to eradicate or edit out or fix or get rid of, you know. And there's this suggestion in the poem that you actually can't know yourself completely until you've met every one of those parts, I mean, including and maybe even especially the ones you wish weren't a part of the story. And I got to do all of that, or I got to begin the work of doing that in the solitude of my walk. And of course, it's work that continues today, this moment, you know.
You spoke before of pain and how people shared their own pain with you, but you were also exploring your own pain. You're very close to your mother, but as you say in this book, your parents' divorce when you were 15 was a profound rift. Say a little bit about how that, exploring that in your walk, was part of this process.
Well, I didn't realize this would happen when I set out to walk, but what ended up happening was because I found myself in an environment where so many of the distractions were stripped away, you know, where I was spending most days just there on the side of the road and not listening to music or podcasts or checking emails. You know, I didn't have a smartphone. I was just there ready to receive whatever came up. And it was almost as if there was now space for all of this sort of unprocessed pain from the divorce and from all the confusion that followed it to come up. And I think I spent more time sobbing on the side of the highway in that 10-month, 11-month span on the road than I had in all the years of my life combined up to that point. And that was critically important work. And it was work. I mean, it's tragic and horrifying that this kind of work has been cast as, you know, petty or, you know, woo-woo or even failure for men especially. I mean, it's like there's still this sort of like antiquated idea that, you know, to be a man, you're supposed to look a certain way and definitely not cry. And what a horrible thing, because what I found from opening up to some of that work is that it initiated me into my humanness, you know, because a part of being human is being vulnerable and being subject to a whole array and spectrum of emotion. And I have found both liberation and being willing to feel all of it, like whatever comes, as opposed to like trying to curate my experience and only feel, you know, only feel strong and happy, and the other stuff not allowed to feel, you know. But so there's freedom in opening up to a diversity of experience, and then there's wisdom in it too. It's like that is the foundation from which I'm able to connect with people. The degree to which I've been willing to explore the fullness of my breakable heart is the degree to which I'll be able to connect with other people and their breakable hearts. You know, otherwise, you know, if I'm hiding from myself, I'm not going to be able to fully be there with another. And so that all began to happen in solitude on the road. And it's, I think, a similar kind of thing that begins to happen in silent meditation retreat, you know, or in the wilderness by yourself, or, you know, it can happen anywhere. You don't have to walk across America to do these things. I think actually it's like imperative to remember that this is just simply, in some ways, there's nothing more extraordinary about my experience than anyone else's. We're all living this extraordinary thing called our lives, you know.
Yeah, and also in the command for spontaneity, that such a walk allows that space, it opens up that space to do that, you are able to connect with what was real in others, so that you had so many experiences of people just telling you that they loved you.
Yeah.
I mean, talk about, like, I'm thinking, I have this name here on my notes, Nettie Harlow in Virginia. Tell us about her.
Yeah, well, I found myself lost one day in the backwoods of southern Virginia on this sort of mountaintop, and there were a few houses here and there in the woods. And I eventually stumbled across this lawn, or this house where this grandma came out. And we got to talking. She brought me in and fed me food, and we started connecting. And again, I was just, you know, listening and asking questions and, you know, just being open. And And I found that, yeah, I mean, she was reciprocating in that way. And eventually she wouldn't let me sleep outside. She made me sleep in her guest room and took me out for some ice cream, you know, just like this. Again, everything took on a surreal sheen, the same thing. And as I'm going to bed that night, we had played music together, and it was just, again, wow, this is, it was like I was getting a glimpse into a whole other world that was made possible by that open-heartedness, that refusal to respond with any form of malice or suspicion, you know, just trust and compassion. And it was this whole other world. And I was going up to bed, and she said, "Good night, Andrew. I love you."
Yeah.
And out of my mouth came the words, "I love you too," you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. And over again with all different kinds of people, I found that it was impossible to hate someone who I had listened to and who had entrusted me with the story of how they'd become who they were, even if they held opinions that I found reprehensible or even dangerous. It didn't mean I agreed with them, far from it, but I found it impossible to hate them.
If you just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Andrew Forstoffel about his book, Walking to Listen. And that was something you found a lot. I mean, sometimes people said incredibly hateful things, particularly
yeah.
White people said hateful things about black
right.
people. I mean, there
yes.
was prejudice everywhere, including by the people who fed you dinner and took you in. And you struggled with that. How did you deal with it?
Well, clumsily, much of the time. I was learning how to deal with that, how to show up as a listener, how to keep the purity of my intention, this intention to listen, to understand, this refusal to engage in any form of violence, verbal, psychic, or physical, you know, but also not become passive, you know. And what I've come to believe is that listening is not a glaze-eyed, passive willingness to just, like, agree with whatever comes out of someone's mouth. There's a way to receive someone and disagree with them at the very same time and kindly report to them the consequences of their beliefs without expectation that they should change. And there's a way in which listening to someone in that way, you know, without needing to convert them or, you know, manipulate them, has a way of giving them space to actually explore something they might not explore otherwise, like in an argument or a debate. So there's a transformative potential in listening in this way. But it was hard. And the thing I struggled with most was my own silence. You know, like people would say something to me, and something racist, for example, or homophobic, and much of the time I would find myself saying nothing. And I realized, my God, this is the appalling silence of the good people that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was talking about. Like, it's in me. And so how do I show up? And a friend of mine just suggested that I ask questions, you know, like, what is it? Okay, I hear what you're saying. Tell me what it's like to believe that. What is the lived experience of believing that? What is your life like believing that? And why? Why do you believe it? And then just going from there, you know, without any malice. It's hard, and I failed a lot and continue to, you know, but that doesn't mean I've stopped trying.
Could you give us an example of a time when you did do that and what happened?
When I did listen in that way?
Yeah.
Yeah. There was a guy outside New Orleans. So I'm walking into New Orleans, and people had warned me about walking into the city because they thought I was going to get shot, you know. And so the sun is setting just as I'm coming to the outskirts of town, and I hear from behind me this guy go, "Hey." And I look around and keep walking. And then he goes, "Hey, you, Walker." And I'm like, all right, I should probably go over there. So I cross the road to go to this guy, and he asks me what I'm doing. He's standing up on his porch, glowering down at me, you know. And he goes, "What are you doing?" And I said, "Oh, I'm Andrew. I'm walking to listening to people's stories across, you know, America. I started in Philadelphia, I'm heading maybe to California. We'll see how far I go." "Philadelphia? So you're a damn Yankee. Well, who the heck invited you down here?" And he didn't say heck. Okay. And he goes, well, that's neutral ground you're standing on right there, but as soon as you come on the mile line, that's my territory. So I was trying to stay connected to my intention, right, to listen to this guy and to refuse to reciprocate his violence, and felt that it was time to leave. You know, so I turned and said, hey, I'm not trying to cause any problems. I really am here to listen, but if you're not into it, I'll continue, you know. So I turned and left, and then he goes, hey, wait. Do you like beer? And I said, yeah. He goes, do you want one? And so I go up to this guy's porch and go into his house, and we sit down at his table, and he takes out some beers, and I get to listen to him. And his stories are filled with violence, filled with racism, filled with fear, basically, at the heart of it. And he was telling me this one story, and he said, as if it were this casual little detail, and he said it as if he hadn't said it at all. He goes, you know, such and such and so and so, and I was really pissed off that day because I had to bury my son, you know, and such and so and so. And that was the moment. There was the opening. Okay, there is the kernel inside this man. There's that little piece inside him that is worth relating to, that is capable of feeling, that is already heartbroken, or heartbroken without being willing to feel it, you know, and that's calloused over with all this hate. And it didn't justify or excuse his violence or hatred in any way. But, as I was saying, what it did do was it made it impossible for me to hate him. It made me uninterested. I'm not interested in hating this human being. There's a human being here underneath all these violent beliefs. And so it just challenged any black and white or good versus evil dichotomy I had in my mind and made it, as I say, just impossible for me to want to eradicate him or delete him from the story, you know?
Right. And how did that end up, that encounter? I mean, did you explore things with him that brought out, I don't know, something that might have changed both, not only you, but him?
Well, at that time, I still, and also in that moment, I didn't feel safe to ask the questions I might feel confident enough to ask now. So questions of, well, hold on, you just said this about black people. What do you mean? And why do you believe that? And what's it like to believe that? You know, I was learning how to do this. And the way I'm speaking about these things now, I was a freshman in this school of listening at the time. And so in that particular moment, yeah, I wasn't able to go any further with him, and also was just sensitive to the fact that I was still very vulnerable. Over a thousand miles away from home. I didn't actually know this guy, and he still might, who knows, you know? And he was going in and out of openness and fear. And, you know, at one point in the conversation, he sort of narrowed his eyes and looked around, and he goes, where's my cat? Huh, he must not like you. You know, so it was tenuous, and I was totally undefended. I was footbound, you know? And so I did what I could.
But let me ask you now, I know that since that time, you have been working with people, you've been giving workshops on how to listen, basically. Something, you know, my goodness, you wrote this in, what, 2012, or you went on your journey in 2012, is that right?
Yeah, 2011 to 2012.
Right, and now we're 2017, in a country that we're in a very difficult place politically, let's just say, where people haven't felt heard and aren't all that particularly willing to listen to each other. What are you finding in the work that you're doing now? And, you know, what's maybe one thing you would like to leave us with in terms of how we can go out and listen to others?
Well, I guess the thing I would offer would be that something else becomes possible when sincerity is the vehicle of the conversation. Sincerity and openness, vulnerability, and the refusal to respond with any kind of violence. And violence mostly is not physical. You know, violence, you know, comes in through words most of the time and thoughts and the way we see each other, perceive each other. And so, you know, something else becomes possible in that space of sincerity and vulnerability, and simply reporting to someone the repercussions of what that someone believes without harming them in kind. And so, you know, what I was trying to do on this walk was find questions like that that could come out of me sincerely and then ask them. And it's hard to ask a question like that because sometimes it'll reveal something about you that you might not want people to see. And we're also not trained, most of us aren't trained to see each other as unconditionally, irrefutably, and unavoidably worthy. There's this idea that some people are unworthy, or we'd be better off without them. And so this listening practice has everything to do with healing that delusion, the delusion that we'd be better off if we'd built a wall, you know. So I think it's really important to consider the ways in which we respond to the people we wish weren't a part of the story, you know, because it's so easy to become the very thing we're resisting in them, in our relationship to them. So to just watch and to try to find that sincerity.
Well, Andrew Forsthoffel, your book is Walking to Listen, 4,000 Miles Across America, One Story at a Time. It's a beautiful book, and this has really been a beautiful conversation. Thank you.
Thank you.
Andrew Forsthoffel. His radio documentary about his journey across America aired on This American Life. Find a link to it at writersvoice.net. You'll also find a link to his website that has much more about his journey, including photos and videos. Next up, Rob Okun talks about pro-feminist men. Stay tuned after the break.
Whether it starts with an earthquake or the tears of a few grieving women, I don't know. They're on the road to Galilee. Looking for someone to roll away the stone. He stands alone in her room as the commotion slowly decays. Somewhere new, looking for someone to roll away the stone.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. As I produced our first segment today with Andrew Forsthoffel, I was so struck by his heartfelt sensibility that I wanted to keep the feeling alive as we moved into our second segment. I felt a good pairing was the following interview I did back in 2014 with feminist Rob Okun. He's dedicated his life to the proposition that men can only be fully human when women are fully equal. He's been dedicating himself to the pro-feminist cause since the early 1980s. He was a founder of the Men's Resource Center for Change in Amherst, Massachusetts, and started that organization's magazine, Voice Mail, in 1982. He now publishes it independently. Okun's book brings together articles from Voice Mail over the years to present a fascinating portrait of the development of the pro-feminist men's movement. The title is Voice Mail, The Untold Story of the Pro-Feminist Men's Movement. I spoke with him in 2014. Here's an edited version of our conversation. I started out our conversation by asking Rob Okun to define pro-feminism.
Pro-feminism is really, from my perspective, it's men supporting the concept of feminism and all of that entails. I mean, I use the term pro-feminism as opposed to feminist man or male feminist because, as my colleague, the sociologist Michael Kimmel, has said, you know, feminist involves the empirical observation that women and men are not equal in either the private or the public sphere. And it also recognizes that while men may agree with that kind of an assessment of women's subordinate status, you know, and men may want to work towards equality, men can believe in feminism, but to be a feminist requires another ingredient, the felt experience of oppression. And that's something that men can't feel because men aren't oppressed but are privileged by sexism. So being a pro-feminist is certainly keeping in the same spirit the values and the visions of feminists, but recognizing that as men, that term of declaring oneself a feminist is reserved, in my estimation, for women.
Now, you've been involved in the pro-feminist movement for a long time, at least since 1983, if not before. You were one of the founders of the Men's Resource Center in Amherst, Massachusetts. How did you find yourself as part of, and even in some ways a pioneer of this movement, at least the latter, this more modern phase of the pro-feminist movement? What in your own personal history brought you to this point?
The portal for me, the doorway that I came through most assertively was by becoming a father. And while it isn't essential for every man to be a father to recognize the value of embracing a pro-feminist position, I think in the 3 decades or so that I've been a dad that my responsibilities and my accessing the nurturing side of myself really awakened something that I think is in most men, is in all men when we're born, innately, you know, arriving on the planet with a clean slate. But I'm a writer and an editor, and I used to do a lot of radio commentaries. And when my children were small, I would write essays and do radio commentaries about the experience of being a dad. That was one strand that led me into this work. I think the other thing that happened for me was in the early 80s, I became aware of what was called feminist art, some of the work that Miriam Shapiro or Judy Chicago were doing. And I sort of was always interested in socially engaged art in general. And when I started to look at women's experiences in making art that addressed their circumstances, that kind of awakened another piece of the story. And then maybe the other component was a little bit of envy as I saw women in women's groups dropping in deep, having rich and meaningful conversations that explored their interior lives. I felt, as a lot of men did, a hunger for that, which initially might have been masked by some insecurity and confusion about where are all these women going off and having these gatherings together and what about me and, you know, doesn't one's partner have the capacity to be all things to all, you know, to their partner. So I think there was a lot of strands. I kind of told it in a inverse way, leading with the fatherhood piece. But I think that was the one that consistently allowed me to want to grow and explore my own interior life.
In his book, Voicemail, Rob Okun makes a point pretty early on that notions of masculinity, while they confer privilege on men, also damage men. I asked him to talk about how those notions damage men.
Well, when, as men, we don't have as full a range of expression of our inner life, we suffer. We repress most of our feelings. We're not given a whole lot of permission to shed tears, you know, except if we, you know, win the game and, you know, or have some great emotional moment in the popular culture. and that our range of emotional expression ranges from anger to anger. So we're walking around with a lot of feelings that are bottled up inside. One of the exercises we used to do in the batter's intervention groups was talking about the emotional funnel, which if over the course of a day, small irritations that just get stuffed down and stuffed down and stuffed down, that they're just going to eventually, you know, have no place to go but come out. And while the majority of men are certainly not acting violently, a lot of men are not in touch with their feelings, and everybody knows some man whose best strategy for dealing with his inner life is to shut down, and he's moody, leave him alone, don't talk to him, he'll come out of it. But we're not really encouraging men to take on, doing therapy. I mean, all of these things are much better today than they were even 10, 15 years ago. But we live in a culture that starts from the earliest days telling little boys when they fall down and hurt themselves, the standard line, big boys don't cry. And that's where it begins. We hold back from finding our true selves, our full selves, expressing our full selves. And so that plays itself out in a lot of ways. The health issues are pretty stark. The high blood pressure and this other stress-related issues, our life expectancy compared to women, the amount of heart disease, all across the board, these are all aspects of, you know, toxic expression of masculinity that doesn't allow us to break out of, you know, what a lot of us in this work call the man box, that regimented space where acting like a cool, tough, strong, you know, stud is the message that we're given. And if we deviate from that, then we're going to get slammed outside. So that's how it plays out negatively in our health, in our both our physical health and our mental health.
In fact, your co-founder of the Men's Resource Center, Steve Botkin, talks about masculinity as a product, and he says it has a lot to do with disconnection. That and then he says that violence and domination are a way to connect. I wonder if you could connect the dots between those two things, between disconnection and violence as a way to connect.
Well, it's been pretty demonstrated over and over that when we don't have any sense of belonging, when we are feeling that sense of isolation, and we want to have some kind of way to be in the world, that the default is to act out. I mean, it's a sad fact. I mean, we take it to the family member at the holidays who, never really learned how to get along with people and socialize, and suddenly there's that outburst at the family at the dinner table. Well, he's moody. He's shut down. But we take it to its extreme because we're not really interested in how we look at our sons. And of course, all of this is changing, and that's why the pro-feminist men's movement and a book like Voicemail and the magazine that shares its name is out there to offer some different ways of looking at these issues. Violence in the culture is really part of what men have been offered as our way to feel some sense of power. And it's a real negative power in this because at heart, most of us want to do the right thing, but we're so stuck in old ideas of what it means to be a man that we're unable to fully reach in and touch the parts of ourselves that we didn't really know existed because we weren't given permission. So one of my colleagues, Alan Johnson, who wrote one of the most important books on the topic of patriarchy called The Gender Knot, but he wrote a piece that's in the book, Fatal Distraction, Manhood, Guns, and Violence, in which he looks at the issue of power and control, and that, you know, guns and violence, he writes, are instruments of control, whether used by states or by individuals. They otherwise have no intrinsic value on their own. Their value comes from the simple fact that violence works as a means to intimidate, to dominate, and control. It works for governments and hunters. It works for police and batterers. It works for parents and schoolyard bullies, corporations, and, by extension, anyone who wants to feel larger and more powerful and in control than they otherwise would. So that's at base where a lot of men are coming from. They want to feel some sense of control, and they want to have that power. And for a lot of men today, with the world changing the way it is, it's a very confusing time. They think that women are somehow taking over when, of course, it's their inability to get in touch with that disconnect between their real lives and what's happening out in the world that's undermining their own ability to transform and to grow.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Rob Okun about his book. He's the editor of the book Voicemail, The Untold Story of the Pro-Feminist Men's Movement. He was the editor since 1983 of the magazine Voicemail and a co-founder of the Men's Resource Center in Amherst, Massachusetts.
I asked Rob Okun to comment on the idea that feminism has led to poorer outcomes for boys.
Saying that somehow because we've put attention on improving circumstances for girls and women, that somehow boys are getting the short end of the stick. What we finally recognize is that we haven't been looking at boys in a way that has been helpful to them. The ways that we've been raising boys and educating boys hasn't been allowing us to find that fuller expression of our humanity. So at a time when a lot of attention and funding went towards improving circumstances for girls, it wasn't that we took away from boys. It's that we were recognizing that we hadn't been offering girls enough. And once we started to do that, it allowed some space for critiques to come up to say, well, what about the boys? And now we're at a place where young men are getting more attention, not just in the academic sphere, but I think as importantly in our extracurricular activities. And all of this for me comes down to, are we helping boys at a really young age to connect with their hearts? Are we encouraging them to developing their nurturing side, their capacity to be compassionate? Those are the kinds of aspects of their emotional intelligence that have been underappreciated, undervalued, and underexplored. And I think that more than anything else, if we put our attention there, is going to both improve boys' lives, and of course, if they are more in touch with themselves and if their emotional intelligence is cultivated, then everyone in their lives, regardless of gender, is going to benefit from being connected to them.
This is kind of the issue here, or the difficult issue here, which is that at the same time that boys could gain so much from pro-feminism, men and boys would be giving something up, and that is privilege.
Well, it depends on how you interpret that word. It's true that, I'm paraphrasing Frederick Douglass, but power gives up nothing without a fight. And for those of us who just arrived, we didn't have anything to do with it. We just arrived in these male-identified bodies that somehow that we're in have special entitlement, special privilege. It's unfair. So if your bottom line for how you want to operate both as a individual or in a community or in a society is fairness, then you're going to say, I've had a good ride as a male with a lot of privileges and entitlements, and I certainly don't want to see my daughter or my sister get the short end of the stick, so I'm going to be willing to shift. I'm going to be willing to change. And the problem for a lot of men is that when they first confront the fact that they do have privilege and they do have entitlement, is if I lose that, what am I gaining? And they don't have an answer to that. And I think the answer that the book, if taken as a whole, and the movement as taken as a whole, offers as an answer is that you have your own full expression of your humanity. You have your full life to live. Maybe you're going to be healthier. Maybe you're going to be less stressed out. Maybe you're going to be more connected to your spouse and your children. Maybe, God forbid, or goddess forbid, maybe you're going to be happier.
You say in the book that you are very hopeful. You're a kind of half glass full guy. But as I look around the gender landscape, I see more the glass half empty. I mean, I see an incredible growth of anti-women politics on the national scale, a sports culture that really denigrates women, boys who seem to be growing up with ideas that women are just to be exploited sexually. It seems in many ways worse than what I knew in the 1980s, you know, after 10 years of the women's movement that began in the 70s. I wonder if you could talk about kind of the forces of reaction and why you're still so hopeful.
You know, we're in a situation now where there's only one direction to go, and that's, you know, towards a more gender-just world. And we are going to be experiencing some of the short-term setbacks. It's no question that it's unconscionable and unnerving and unbelievable that we're having to work so hard to protect and make sure that women's reproductive rights are maintained and increased at a time when we thought those struggles had been waged and won decades ago. And there's no question that we are at a time where there is a more overt expression of sexual violence and sexual assault. But part of that is when problems that have been occluded from a lot of us for a long time are suddenly exposed, that in that period of opening the wound before the healing can happen and the full recuperation can happen, we have to go through some of the pain. So in the case of violence against women, you know, it was 20 years ago that the then senator from Delaware, Joe Biden, was a key figure in shepherding the Violence Against Women Act through Congress, and it made incredible difference to women's lives. And we found in the last year or two, until it finally passed, that there was tremendous resistance to reauthorizing it because it was recognizing other kinds of violence against lesbians and Native Americans, and the forces of reaction were wanting to keep it really simple. We only want to be helping these women. We don't want to be helping all the women. And we're at a time where, because men, some feeling threatened, are speaking out, holding on to the end of their privilege, that we are finding ourselves having to revisit some of the struggles and the battles that we thought we'd won. But if one looks at the first chapter of the book, which really looks at this untold story of the pro-feminist men's movement, that first chapter profiles about 20 organizations that are currently active taking on all of these issues. And they're national, and they're regional, and they're wide-ranging in what they're doing. But one of my colleagues who we just talked about, my friend Michael Kimmel, his latest book is called Angry White Men. And the subtitle is really kind of interesting because it's American Masculinity at the End of an Era. And I think that's the key here. When you're maybe feeling, and maybe some of the your friends and other women that you know may be feeling a little bit despairing about how the gender justice landscape looks today, I think that's important to be remembering, that this is American Masculinity at the End of an Era, and maybe in a way voicemail the untold story of the pro-feminist men's movement is the beginning of that new era, where the most important thing that we as men can do is to speak out. too many of us take the role of bystander and have allowed those minority of voices, whether it's the sexual assaulters in the military or the minority of priests who've abused boys and girls in the church, or the men's rights activists who seek to define masculinity in that old stereotyped Marlboro Man way. For us to sit back and be quiet is a form of collusion. And I think that for men today, there's probably more men who would be defined as pro-feminist. There are probably millions of us, and they just don't know it. Because when you ask a man, just as if you ask a 18-year-old college first-year female who might say, oh, feminism, that's not a word that I embrace. I don't describe that. And then you ask her about all of these privileges and rights that her mom has talked to her about, and she said, of course I believe in all of those. Well, that's the definition of feminism, of just fairness, and I want to be able to have the same job and I want to have the same opportunities. Well, you ask men that, and they're going to say the same thing now. So we're really at the beginning of this new era, and I think that whether or not one uses the word pro-feminist or anti-sexist or just, I just want to do the right thing, I'm not as interested in the terminology as I am in advancing this transformation of men and masculinity.
I am heartened by what you say. I just have one final question, which is, do women have a role in men's healing from sexism and masculinity?
Of course. My experience is, and I don't know if I coined this term, but it's one I've been using a long time, is that most of us as men were pretty lacking in an ability to speak emotional ease, a language that women are fluent in, and that we stumble around trying to just have the most basic terms. So because of the ways, this is, you know, we need a whole other show to talk about women's socialization, but I think that the upside of growing up female, one of them, is that emotional ease of being able to get in and explore the inner life. So women have a lot to offer men in finding our hearts and exploring how we connect our heads and our hearts and advance the best of what we can be as people.
It's a wonderful book, and this has been a wonderful conversation, Rob Okun. I've known of your work for many years. Your work in the Men's Resource Center in Amherst and the pro-feminist movement, and now in editing this book, Voicemail. I want to thank you so much for talking with us here.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you, Francesca.
Rob Okun. His book, Voicemail, is out from Interlink Books. Read an excerpt by going to writersvoice.net. And that was my 2014 interview with Rob Okun. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox, or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.